Okay, thank you, Svi asked me to give an overview of amplitudes that have been computed in string theory, and that is useful for the interaction with, the ambitwister program. Today, I will basically try to tell you they are true, whether they are useful, see. And in my last transparency, I'll tell you some things that are useful, but probably not true. Since it's an overview, I actually decided to use transparencies. But you should not view that as intended to inhibit questions. In fact, the opposite. So, because now I don't need to waste my time writing on the board, so please interrupt me at any point, and we'll see what we can do. So, QFT, I don't need to tell you, is, of course, the theory of the world, but its calculation of amplitudes is hindered by the fact that you have a rapidly increasing number of Feynman diagrams with external states and with a number of loops. On the other hand, if you look at closed strings, there seems to be only one diagram per order in loops. And governed by, which is what I will explain, field theory on a compact super Riemann surface, whose number of handles is the number of loops. So of course I can see why the amplitudes community is interested in strength. Replacing n factorial or whatever number of diagrams by one diagram sounds great. However, the amplitudes people really have beaten the string theory people in the number of loops, definitely, and actually in the number of external states as well. You're now up to five loops, certainly four loops acquired, five loops in progress, and string theory is nowhere there. So I view this workshop for me actually also as intended for me to learn something from the amplitudes people and perhaps apply it to string theory. I will not really talk much about open closed strings. We've heard beautiful, there has been beautiful work, and we've heard beautiful talks by Schlotter and Steberger in the conference. And I'm going to concentrate on closed strings. And so, as an overview, I've collected basically sort of four topics. I'll start with giving you sort of an overview of the prototypes of amplitudes that are known. Then I'll tell you a bit how they are constructed in the RNS formulation from the conversations I've had with Ricardo and Yvonne. It's clear that this may be relevant to the ambitwist of string. And I'll talk a bit about supermoduli, which are one of the key difficulties in this program, and perhaps also in the ambitwist of string. And then the last part is essentially recreational string theory. Once we have gotten through the first three, this will be a piece of cake and just for fun. And it will also perhaps satisfy one of Lance's desiderata, which is to actually integrate some stuff. So I'm going to start with something that you have probably all seen, but just in case, this goes back to work before the first string revolution by Green and Schwartz, is the four graviton amplitude in type, I wrote type 2b, but it's actually type 2, four graviton amplitude to one loop. So here is the amplitude, depends on some polarization tensors, which I pick to be factorized, as I think you also do. And this amplitude has a kinematical factor, which is very celebrated and arises in 10 dimensional supergravity as well, built out of the Green-Schwartz rank 8 tensor in this following way. And the dependence on the left and right chiralities epsilon are factored in this way, just a product. Then we have an integral over moduli space for one loop, which is the upper half Poincaré plane bounded by modular transformations, SL2Z. And we integrate with a metric here, which is invariant under these modular transformations, and then a partial amplitude, which is the integral over four copies of the surface of the torus with some Green's function, the Green's function of the torus. I didn't write it down, but I think everybody knows. And here I've used Mandelstam variables that are actually dimensionless. I find that convenient, and we just say that, you know, in the real physical world, these things are all small compared to one. And there are analogous formulas for heterotic strings with more external states. In the literature, there is a long literature that goes back to the 80s, but I will not really review all that here. Importantly, what is the singularity structure of this amplitude? Well, if you fix tau, if you work on a fixed Riemann surface, then you're really doing conformal field theory or superconformal field theory on a fixed surface. And the singularities are governed by the OPE singularities of the vertex operators. And it doesn't take you long to figure out that the partial amplitude B has poles only at integer S. With this normalization, closed string poles are at integers. No cuts. It is the integral over tau that produces cuts. In fact, if you look at it, you will see that it is convergent, absolutely, only when the Mandelstam variables are purely imaginary, so that this stuff is all a phase. So you need to analytically continue. And the only way I know how to do that is by cutting up moduli space. So even though this is a tantalizingly, extraordinarily simple formula with one diagram, secretly, you really need to look into the decomposition of even this simple moduli space to understand the physical singularities. So in particular, the massless singularity, so in other words, for fixed tau, anywhere in the interior of moduli space, there are no cuts. There is no contribution from physical massless particles. You need to go to the cusp to see those. And that, of course, has a close connection with the ambi-twister string, which is supported at the cusp. Okay, now this is a one-loop amplitude, but actually you haven't seen any internal loop momenta. But that's no problem. They can be exposed rather easily. And this is, in fact, a crucial ingredient that will be useful also to higher loops. So how do we do this? Well, for the torus, it's very simple. You all know you can pick a canonical basis of cycles of first homology and introduce one loop momentum, I'll call it P mu, which flows through a cycle of the torus. Let's take it the A cycle. And then, in fact, you can show that the amplitude, I omitted here the kinematical factor, which is just overall, can be written as an integral over this 10-dimensional loop momentum of the integral of moduli. And then of an absolute value square of a locally holomorphic function in the insertion positions of the vertex operators and in the modulus. So I wrote it down here. So now, of course, this depends on the momentum and on the positions of the vertex operators. And theta is the standard Jacobi theta function, which vanishes at the origin. The cost is that this holomorphic function has monodromy. So if I take one of the vertex points and cycle it around an A cycle, then F picks up a phase. Of course, this phase is irrelevant in the final formula because the final formula involves an absolute value. If I take one of the points around the B cycle, then that shifts the momentum by the corresponding momentum of the insertion. And that's also irrelevant because the integration measure over P is invariant on the translations. Modular invariance guarantees that we made some choices that things are independent of choices. And this fact that at fixed momentum, the amplitude factorizes into holomorphic times anti-holomorphic should actually be familiar from conformal field theory, where you have the two chiral parts and they're paired by Hermitian metric, okay, and then you basically insist on modular invariance to determine or narrow down what that metric is. So the conformal families, or the conformal blocks in this case, are labeled by P, by the loop momentum. So this is actually, from a conformal field theory point of view, an extremely natural formula. And of course, you have monodromies in these blocks. You're not asking questions.
Okay, I'll ask one. Thank you. I mean, it looks like Schwinger parameters. I'm doing the Schwinger parameterizations course, but,
yes.
But then there's additional tau dependence in theta 1 from the massive states. So,
right.
Any comment on that?
There is, yes. So, in fact, you could to go to really the field theory limit, you would like to throw away powers of Q. Q is e to the 2 pi I tau. And you can do that. You'll be left with a sine function or so there is a way of doing this. Of course, it will break modular invariance and so. But and you can recover the massless singularities in this way. Other questions? Okay, well, this is one loop. This is all, of course, very familiar. Now, in order to discuss two loops, I need to give you a little bit of information on genus 2 surfaces. So it's probably easiest to begin with the generalization of the moduli space. So for genus 2, the starting point is a so-called Ziegle upper half space, which is a space of 2x2 symmetric complex-valued matrices, which whose imaginary part is positive. And SP4R is the analog of SL2R for the upper half plane, and transforms these period matrices in this fractional transform way. Of course, these are now matrices. And this space, so this is the upper half space, so this is 6 real dimensions. Okay, it's not ADS because it's completely, completely different group here, but it's something close to ADS. And this space carries a metric, an invariant metric, which I wrote down in an associated volume form, which is also invariant. So what's the relation with Riemann surfaces? Well, if you now consider a compact Riemann surface of genus 2, and you choose some canonical set of homology cycles. So a canonical set simply means that A and B has intersection number 1, and the A's don't intersect the A's, and the B's don't intersect the B's. And you can do this in many different ways, which are related by model transformations. So dual to these, you can introduce holomorphic 1 forms, and you can normalize these. So this is the analog of the normalization for the torus. And then you get, for a given surface, an integral which is a matrix, 2x2 complex, and in fact, which lives in this upper Ziegle upper half space. And in fact, it is true that every period matrix of genus 2 defines a surface. Not uniquely, because SP4Z is the modular group, so the moduli space is actually the Ziegle space divided by SP4. This is something you can write down, you can introduce coordinates, you know everything about, essentially. Okay, so what's known at two loops? So the immediate analog is the type 2 for graviton amplitude at genus 2. So its structure is actually very similar to the case in genus 1. There's, again, the same factor, k tilde, an integral over the moduli space, this measure that I introduced on the previous slide, and then some partial amplitude, which only depends on the Mandelstam variable. So again, the scale of Green's function comes in here. So this is all very similar, except that, of course, now it's for genus 2. Surface. So the only novelty is really these factors y here. And these factors y involve a mixture of the Mandelstam variables and biholomorphic one forms, which I wrote down here. So the omegas are the things on the previous slide. So you see that there is a factorization, but there is a slightly more complicated than at one loop, because in the pairing of holomorphic with anti-holomorphic, I now have different kinematical dependencies. So this amplitude was derived by Fong and me 12 years ago or something, and then reproduced in the pure spinner formulation by Berkowitz and Mafra, who actually also extended by using supersymmetry, space-time supersymmetry, the amplitude to having external fermions. Okay, does that make sense to you?
So, you know, in L loops and field theory, there are the two Szymanczyk polynomials.
I don't know what that is.
One of them is it doesn't depend on the kinematics. And it looks like, I think it looks like the field theory.
This thing?
It looks like det m omega.
Oh, I see, yeah.
The first Szymanczyk polynomial looks like coming out of the field theory limit of that.
Yes.
The second one, at one loop, it looks like e to the sg. I'm just curious about what happens to y in the field theory limit.
Right, okay, I can tell you that.
Kind of b looks like if it absorbs into e to the sg somehow in that one.
Yeah, so basically if I take the limit, so now I have a genus 2 surface. I actually do have a blackboard, I guess. So we have a genus 2 surface. So the field theory limit is gotten basically by degenerating both of these to thin cycles. And so you can now give, you can assign L1, L2, and L3 as Feynman parameters to the corresponding propagators. Okay. And then that of imaginary part of omega goes to something like L1, L2, plus L2, L3, plus L3.
Yeah, that's the first Szymanczyk polynomial or two loops.
Right. Yes.
But then what about Y wedge, Y bar? The question is, what does that thing become?
That, okay, I didn't write it out here, but actually, Mike Green and Pierre Van Hove computed type 2b and M-theory, but mainly type 2b amplitudes using the world line formulation, pure spinners, and had an answer, and then found that actually with this kind of structure, this answer can be written quite naturally. So it does, in fact, show up naturally. You have to do the limit of these differentials in this case and so, but yes, that works all fine. Mm-hmm.
Right, that must be, coming out of the numerator factor in the world line or undiagonal.
And it.
It's going to give this S squared, T squared, squared as a pure double losses.
Okay. Which in N equals 8 doesn't have much. You can factor out all of it.
Right. Other questions? Okay. What's the singularity structure? Again, for fixed omega, you find only the poles due to the OP of the vertex operators. And it's the integral over omega is very similar. You need to analytically continue. Most importantly, perhaps for the connection with ambitwister strength, the leading massless singularity comes from the case where you degenerate both of these cycles to infinity. Okay, well, there's a similar formula for heterotic strings, which is a little bit more complicated. Now there are some genuine modular forms that appear. The Guza form is the analog for genus 2 of the cusp form, delta, in genus 1. And then you can see that the superstring part, the right movers part, leave behind this characteristic kinematical factor and also this Y factor. But then, depending on which amplitudes you're looking at for the scattering of four Nevers-Schwarz bosons, you have different factors or integrand numerator factors coming in for the left-moving part. So there are basically four channels here four gravitons, two gravitons, two bosons, two gauge bosons, and four gauge bosons, each with two channels. And so here, for example, I wrote down what goes in here for four graviton scattering. The gauge part you obtain by inserting the correlators of the currents for the gauge currents in the hydraulic strength.
Remind me, which was the cusp form at one loop? Is it holomorphic?
Yeah.
J?
Or no, it's delta. Delta is a modular form of wave 12. It's G4 cubed minus G6 squared or something like that. And it has the property that it vanishes only at infinity at the cusp. Similarly here, this has no singularities in the interior of moduli space, because if it did, you would really be in trouble. I mean, you would have really unphysical singularities. So that's essential. These delta and psi 10 are essentially the discriminants of the curve, so they can only vanish when the curve degenerates. Other questions? Okay. So now here I will give a brief summary of how you actually get there to the construction of these amplitudes. And I want to basically stress the main difficulties that are probably also difficulties in the ambi-twister strength. So the key thing is that in the RNS formulation, you have world sheet fermions that are space-time vectors, psi. If you had a Minkowskian signature on the world sheet, of course it would be crazy to do that, but if you did, then psi and psi tilde would be independent Majorana-Weyl spinners, and the Dirac equation solved by left movers and right movers. That's, in a way, the way the fundamental structure is. But if we go to an Euclidean world sheet, then tau minus sigma becomes a complex number, and the left movers are complex conjugate. And so naturally, psi and psi tilde are complex Weyl spinners, and they are naturally complex conjugates of one another, and that's not good. And a lot of the complication actually comes from disentangling this, and I will say more about it. So in particular, if you do this now on a compact Riemann surface, there is no way in the world you should use Minkowskian world sheet metric. So use, of course, Euclidean signature metric. You have local complex coordinates. The Dirac equation gives you these things in terms of locally holomorphic functions. Globally, psi are sections of a spin bundle. And the spin bundle is the same for all mu, if you're in a Lorentz invariant theory, because these things get rotated into one another. And so Lorentz invariance requires that they be the same. So what's a spin bundle? Well, essentially, it's the square root of the holomorphic tangent bundle, cotangent bundle. So their squares are all isomorphic to the holomorphic square. But when you take the square root, then you introduce spin structures. So these are actually spin bundles. And for a surface of genus G, there are this many different spin structures. And the key thing is that, in fact, these spin bundles need to be independent of one another. This is demanded by the GSO projection, by which you will sum over spin structures independently for left and right movers.
Greg, with regard to your comment that you'd be crazy to have a Minkowski world.
Well, we've done this, but.
well, for example, if you use something like the Lightcone decomposition of moduli space, then on each sort of cylinder you can make them basically Lorentzian. And you know, that's related to this need to break up the moduli space to make the continuation that you already talked about.
Absolutely.
So I'm not sure why you're saying this is crazy.
Okay, you know, maybe I should be more careful in my dramatic statements. But I mean, for the bosonic string, you and I show that this works great, in a way. And there is an analog for the superstring, which I spent quite a bit of time on, and which, however, is singular. And it is very difficult to avoid the singularities at the interaction points. And this was also practiced in the Green-Schwarz string.
Right.
And similarly, there are singularities, contact terms, which Green and Zyberg identified and so. And honestly, although I spent a year working on this, I'm not entirely sure that was ever satisfactory. So maybe this can be taken up again at some point and redone. But certainly much more complicated with the superstring, either in the RNS formulation or in Green Schwartz.
So the issue is the contribution of the supermoduli.
That's right. It's all, yes, that's right. And it's all hidden in there. And it also is related to the fact whether, you know, the interaction points are actually a point or a divisor, which is not the same thing. As we will see later on, Witten actually clarified a lot of things, but did not apply this to the light cone structure. But there must be similar issues. So one could actually, in hindsight, probably come back to it. But for the moment, I don't really know how to explain.
So S and S tilde only have to be independent of each other if you want to get a supersymmetric vacuum.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And many other things. I mean,
have people looked at cases where they're coupled at multi-loop?
Yeah. Well, it's the time zero string.
Yeah.
So it has a tachyon and
yeah.
so on and so forth.
I guess,
So, well, you know, you stop pretty much after that.
There's a non-tachyonic version in the
Right. The SO16, processor 16. I'm not sure anybody, I mean, not that I know, but, you know. Other questions? Okay, so basically, I think the world sheet fields, I think you all know, right? I've written it down for completeness here. You gauge fix, you get ghosts. But in either the type 2 or the heterotic string, it's crucial that left and right movements be independent and have independent spin structures. So we need to find chiral amplitudes, things that are independent, you know, for left and right chiralities. And the way to do this is to link chirality with holomorphicity on modalized space, or for the superstring on supermodalized space. And Fong and I, you know, started this a long time ago, basically by using chiral amplitudes from non-chiral amplitudes by looking at a functional integral where left and right are complex conjugates, and then using holomorphicity to split them apart, and then you keep each and you work with each. And that's, in fact, how these two-loop amplitudes were computed, for example. But of course, as you know, Witten has written a tome of papers, okay, in which the starting point is somewhat different and is by directly using the holomorphic structure of super-Riemann surfaces. In the end, these two things are very closely related, but Witten really has shown that that his approach makes a definition completely possible and rigorous for all genera, for all higher loop amplitudes. So once you have these chiral amplitudes, then the full amplitude can be constructed, as I will show, by putting left and right together in a particular way, consistent with unitarity and modular invariance. And of course, I don't need to tell you that, well, there is certainly some relation with the double copy treatment in field theory. Okay, so I need to, since the key thing here is going to be holomorphicity, I need to tell you a little bit about the complex structure of moduli and supermoduli. So if you have an orientable two-dimensional manifold with a Riemann metric, it's automatically a Riemann surface, which means it's a complex manifold with holomorphic transition functions. And you can actually write this down pretty explicitly. Complex structure is a map of the tangent space into itself. It squares to -1. And if you have a metric and an orientation, which is the epsilon tensor, then you can actually write it down quite explicitly. And so modalized space for genus H compact Riemann surfaces is the set of equivalence classes of this complex structure, modulo reparametrizations. Now, moduli space itself is a complex manifold. Actually, it's not really a manifold because it has orbifold points. So it's an orbifold. And so its tangent space at any point splits into a holomorphic part and an anti-holomorphic part. And there are associated Beltrami differentials, which are essentially the infinitesimal variations of the metric that similarly decompose. And if decomposition then guarantees, you need to check integrability and so on and so forth, but that, in fact, if defines a complex space, and the dimensions, I think, are probably familiar to you. The one thing that will be useful is that a Beltrami differential is usually viewed infinitesimally, but actually operates perfectly well in a finite region. I'm not saying that it's a global deformation, but you can actually extend this not just to first order, but to, you know, a finite number of orders. And that's useful to know. So if you fix a complex structure with associated complex coordinates and transition functions in which the metric is diagonal, then actually you can make a finite deformation by this kind of construction. Infinitesimally, the Beltrami differential is just a change in conformal structure, but you can go beyond that. Okay, superconformal structure. This dates back to Friedan, Martinek, and Schenker. So we're now interested in super Riemann surfaces because on the world sheet, we have the X field, which describes the position, but then we have psi, and we put them in a super field. So what's a super Riemann surface? So it's a manifold of complex dimension 1/1. This is used for super spaces. It means one commuting and one anti-commuting generator. And so locally, it's like C11, complex plane with a complex nilpotent friend here, which I wrote down. And so by definition, transition functions are super conformal in this. Not just holomorphic. Holomorphic would be too general and would not reproduce a superconformal algebra. It actually has to be superconformal, and I wrote down here what that means. This is a local definition. There is also a global definition, which we're not really used. And so, similarly, the superconformal structure that is defined by the transition function defines a J, curly J, and the moduli space of super Riemann surfaces is that divided by diffeomorphisms. And here are the dimensions. So on the sphere, there is nothing. On the torus, if the spin structure is even, there are no odd moduli. If the spin structure is odd, there is one. And for higher genus, these are the dimensions. Now, for genus 1, there is an odd modulus, but it's a bookkeeping device. It's trivial. There is no real substance in it. As soon as you go to h of equal to 2, then there are 2, and they can multiply together and form a bosonic quantity. And that means that this superspace is, in a sense, curved. So really, this stuff, odd moduli, really appear first at genus 2. Now, I've only given you here the case when there are no punctures. Of course, you know there can be NS punctures and R punctures, and I am vividly encouraged to look at Whitten's papers on this subject, which are crystal clear and, in my view, very useful, especially on R punctures. Okay, so then basically, what is Whitten's prescription for putting together left and right? So let's do this for the heterodic string. So the left is a super Riemann surface. The left is a Riemann surface. This is the non-superstring part, half of the bosonic string, in a sense, with an ordinary moduli space. And on the right, we have a super Riemann surface with a moduli space of super Riemann surfaces. So Whitten's prescription is actually, what do you integrate over? Well, you see, these two spaces don't really match. Right, how do you do this? You have, on the one side, for the bosonic part, you have an ordinary number, and on the super side, you have, an ordinary number plus something anti-commuting. How do you do this? So the proposal is, and no doubt it's true, is that the world sheet is actually in the product of the left ordinary Riemann surface and the right super Riemann surface is a cycle in that space of dimension 1-1. That means that the complex conjugate of Z is identified with Z tilde up to something nilpotent, and you keep the anti-commuting part entirely. There's no projection there. And there is a similar prescription for the moduli space. The same problem arises. So you take the left ordinary moduli space, the right supermoduli space, you take a cycle in it in which you have the bosonic dimension, you identify Z, well, in this case, M tilde with M bar up to something nilpotent, and you keep all of the supermoduli, the odd moduli. So in type 2, there is something similar, which I've written down here. Now, it sounds like there is a dependence on the cycles that you choose, but if you look at the BRST invariant correlation function, then the integrand is a closed form, and hence there is no dependence on the cycle. And this is what Ed calls a super Stokes theorem. So I'm not sure who super Stokes is, but that's what it's called. Yes?
Are any of these cycles or homologous?
Are what?
Homologous to each other.
Homologous to each other. Well, the topology of these superspaces is basically the topology of their reduced spaces. I didn't say, but the reduced space is basically when you set all the anti-commuting, all the nilpotent stuff to zero. So there really is no topology in the odd directions. So from that point of view, in some sense, yes, they are homologous. Yes?
Yeah. There were some statements in papers by Witten that there was a problem with five loops.
I'm going to come to that.
Okay.
Okay, well, actually, I don't want to. I think this is probably fairly familiar to you, how you construct the heterotic string action on the world sheet. So I spelled out some of these ideas here. And the upshot is that you end up with a prescription as an integrand over this moduli times super moduli space with an insertion of the ghost superfields paired against super Beltrami differentials with vertex operators. And you will see that this form doesn't exactly exhibit picture-changing operators, because the picture-changing operators would be obtained effectively by choosing a particular parametrization of this, which is typically singular. Okay, so instead, I'm going to jump to chiral amplitude via chiral splitting, because I think this is perhaps more closely related to the questions of the ambi-twister string. So if you look at the two-dimensional supergravity action for the matter field only, you will see that it involves x and psi and psi tilde. It also actually involves a coupling between left and right chirality spinners. So that doesn't sound very good. But in fact, you can show that the corresponding amplitude, when you integrate over x and psi, and so on and so forth, can actually be split at fixed internal loop momenta. So if you introduce, as we had done for the torus, you're now on a higher genus surface, so you introduce a loop momentum for, well, each loop, which means each A cycle. So you can view this as an operator expressed in terms of x. And so you can actually then show that the amplitude is an integral over all internal loop momenta of a product of chiral amplitudes. What do I mean by a chiral amplitude? Well, if we did type 2b and we looked at four gravitons, then remember that the polarization tensor of the graviton I chose in this factorized basis, so one part depends on one epsilon, the other part depends on epsilon tilde, but also the dependence on moduli and supermoduli is actually split. This dependence is anti-holomorphic, this dependence is holomorphic. So that realizes what we had said before, which is we want to link chirality to holomorphicity. So I can actually, one can actually write down what these partial amplitudes are. So I've done that here. So you have some chiral vertex operators. You have an insertion of an operator that picks out the momentum, the loop momentum. And then you have an insertion of the deformations of the superconformal structure by a deformation of its anti-commuting part and a deformation of its commuting part. So that's the general structure. These things can be computed explicitly. For example, the stress tensor is something you know. It's given by effective rules where the bosons and fermions are contracted with effective holomorphic quantities. In this case, the Zagor kernel, it's the holomorphic Dirac propagator. And the prime form is a mathematical object that essentially generalizes the difference of Z minus W locally to something that's globally defined.
So you have fixes, U and chi. They are not being integrated over.
For the moment, no. That's right. That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So when I mean an amplitude, I actually really mean a partial amplitude before I integrate over the supermoduli. This is only a chiral amplitude. It wouldn't make sense to integrate it over moduli. I need to pair it with its sort of friend, you know, with its opposite chirality friend. Other questions? Okay. So so here I gave you, in fact, a bit of an instruction on the parametrization of supermoduli. Remember I told you I talked a bit about supermoduli. So in principle, you can characterize a superconformal structure with transition functions. But if you've actually ever tried to do that in practice, that's complicated. So in practical calculations are really done by keeping this world sheet gravitino field and using that to deform the supercomplex structure. And that's familiar, actually, as I've already said this to some extent. You can use a local parametrization of bosonic moduli in the conformal invariant theory. You start at a complex structure where the metric is diagonal, and then you can deform by a Beltrami differential. And in fact, in a CFT, you do this by inserting the stress tensor. So putting it all together, if you do this, if you look at deformations of supermoduli in a superconformal invariant theory, you start with a so-called reduce with a bosonic Riemann surface, no odd variables at all, with a given complex, with some complex structure, and then you deform by including Beltrami differentials and world sheet gravitino fields. And you can do that not globally on the moduli, but you can do it in a finite patch, in a sense. Since we're interested in these Beltrami differentials and mu that are generated by odd directions, if you can do this to a finite number of orders, that's good enough. That'll be exact, actually. So that's the power of this method.
You don't have things like 1 over 1 minus mu bar?
No, I have to stop there. That's why I'm saying it's not really global, because if I, in this deformation here, this parametrization gives me a regular metric, provided the norm of mu is less than 1.
But then, when you're going to integrate over mu and these complex functions, so those would be on both sides. So now you're dropping those terms. How can you be sure that that integration will be correct?
Because I'm only going to use this for a mu, which is a nilpotent object in terms of the fermionic Beltrami differentials. Not actually going to use this for a finite mu. I'm going to use it for something that essentially squares to zero. And then this doesn't arise. Other questions? Okay, so now indeed, if we look at the parametrization globally, this kind of construction works locally, but does it work globally? Well, globally, what this requires is that you have a projection of the supermodulized space to its reduced part. And Donaghy and Witten have shown that that does not exist in a holomorphic way for a genus. I wrote here larger or equal than 3. What they showed in their paper was larger or equal to 5. But it is believed that it is not true for genus larger or equal to 3. Okay, and I'll come back to that in a little bit. Yes?
So in morphemia language, this local parametrization is some gauge choice that you're doing?
No. All the gauge choices have been fixed. It's only a question of a parametrization. So of course, if you reparametrize, then the form of the amplitude is invariant under that. Otherwise, you wouldn't be doing something correct. But so there's the gauge choice have all been made here. But it's a question of parametrization.
Oh, but it's how you deform from this gauge.
Yeah, you start with a bosonic surface, and now you dress it with anti-commuting stuff. So you only go infinitesimally away, which is why mu is infinitesimal in a sense, and this will work.
So the mu is bosonic.
Yes. Well, mu is even grading, but it can be, for example, theta 1, theta 2, where theta are anti-commuting, and that's actually what happens.
What does this abstraction mean for practical calculations?
I'm going to come to that. Okay. Yes. Okay, so now I will be very fast on this because time is actually short. I was never intending to cover everything, by the way, but it will be on transparencies. So now for genus 2, which is actually the case that Fong and I looked at, there is a natural projection via a supergeneralization of the period matrix. So we wrote these formulas before for an ordinary surface, but in fact, this admits a generalization to a supersurface with a superconformal structure, and one obtains an object here that can in fact be written down explicitly in terms of a deformation from the reduced space. So here, the omega are the ordinary abelian differentials, S is the Zagor kernel, and chi are the things I use, the gravitino fields on the world sheet, the things I use to deform away from the bosonic surface. You can show that this omega is invariant under supersymmetry transformations on the world sheet and diffeomorphisms, so it's an intrinsically defined object, that it's symmetric and that its imaginary part is larger than zero. And we know in genus 2, as I had said before, every period matrix corresponds to an ordinary Riemann surface. And you'll define the projected thing as given by that value of this omega. And this always works in genus 2. The key also is that this relation is holomorphic on moduli. And the reason is that the Zagor kernel for genus 2 is regular, is non-singular in the interior of moduli space. So this gives you this projection. I can associate with a super geometry, a super point in super moduli space. I can associate a point on moduli space. So I have projected. And that's key to the simplicity of the construction. So now here I just basically put together all the pieces. So we have now chiral amplitudes on super moduli space. We can pick this natural parametrization for genus 2 by the superperiod matrix. And then two anti-commuting supermoduli zeta. This involves a measure part and a correlation function, which you compute in terms of polarization vectors, internal loop momenta, and so on and so forth. And now you can project. Projecting means you integrate over the odd moduli at fixed period matrix and fixed spin structure, and you define these projected measure and correlation functions. For the heterotic string, this L part, the left moving part, would be half of the bosonic string, which you can do, which is well defined. And there are some phase factors when you sum over spin structures, but they're essentially fixed by modular invariance as you had a genus one. So now the last thing that remains to be done is you pair left and right chiral amplitudes. And you integrate over P and omega, and that's basically what I've said here. P has a fairly simple dependence and can be integrated out. And when you do that, then you recover the amplitudes for genus 2 that I gave you earlier. Now, I'm going to...
The bosonic representation of the gauge structure?
It's
fermions.
Yeah, no, in practice, you use fermions. So basically, of the 26, right, you keep 10 as bosonic, and then the remaining you, yeah, I mean, I find that much easier to work with, but, right. Okay, so now to answer some of the questions that came before, I'm first going to ask a question about genus 2. And then about genus 3, what goes wrong, actually? Are there singularities in this projection? So I've written it down nicely here, right, with this relation of the superperiod matrices. But now let's ask whether there are actually singularities. The question is not absurd, because we've shown that this projection, this relation, is holomorphic for fixed moduli in the interior of moduli space, but when you integrate, you really extend to infinity, and so you should compactify. Infinity can contribute, depends on what the singularity structure is there. So the question is basically, are there singularities at the boundary of supermoduli space? This is a rather tricky thing to look at, and not completely unrelated to the question of interaction points that we discussed before. So if I parameterize, for example, the period matrix in this way, then remember it's a 2x2 matrix for genus 2, then U going to 0 is the separating mode, which means I pinch off here and I have two genus 1 surfaces. And when one of these two, sigma or tau, goes to infinity, then I let one of the handles become very skinny. So these are the two fundamental degenerations that I can have. They, of course, intersect and so on and so forth. So if you look at the relation that defined this projection, it involves these holomorphic differentials, which are very nice things. But it also involves the Zagor kernel source, which is also a very nice thing. But it happens to have a singularity. So let's look at that. So what is the Zagor kernel? It's given in terms of genus 2 theta functions in this way in prime form. Prime form is innocuous here. But you can see that if the denominator theta of delta had a zero, then there is a singularity. And in fact, this does happen. When U goes to zero, when I go to this separating degeneration, then you can easily show that this genus 2 theta function degenerates to a product of genus 1 theta, I should have written here, of sigma instead of tau. Sorry about that. Now, you would have to think about the even spin structures of genus 2. There are 10 of those, but there is one particular one which is odd on each genus 1 component. And you see that if you do this degeneration for the odd spin structure, theta is zero. So you actually get, this thing is in the denominator, S actually blows up in that case. So for this particular spin structure, there is in fact a singularity at infinity. Well, then you have to worry, what does this do? So what are the physical effects? Well, actually,
is there a more straightforward explanation of that in terms of the spectrum? Can you remind me whether...
Spectrum. You create basically a zero mode on each component.
Okay.
Because of the spin structure gives you a sort of twist in a sense. So, with certain boundary conditions, you can have a zero mode. With other boundary conditions, you have not. So this is the one in which actually I'd have a zero mode on each component. But actually, these zero modes come in to help you, because there is also a direct determinant for each psi. And so, in fact, this singularity is killed by the zero modes, provided you are in flat 10 dimensions or versions of that, and you have space-time supersymmetry. But there is actually, there are cases where this singularity contributes. So the case that Witten analyzed is when supersymmetry is broken by radiative corrections. Lambs is lighting up here. And so, in fact, these one-loop SUSY breakings were investigated a long time ago by these authors. But we can now ask the question of the two loops effective then. You can actually easily see that in the vacuum energy. You don't need external states at all. And so one can, for example, you need to kill some of these zero modes. The way you do that is, for example, by compactifying or twisting with an orbifold twist. So if you look at Calabi-Yau orbifolds, C2 cross C2, where at tree level you reduce the supersymmetry to just n equal to 1 in four dimensions, then you can evaluate the effect of this singularity, and it turns out there is no effect for E8 cross E8 in the heterotic string, but there is an effect for spin 32. And this is related to the fact that in this case of spin 32, there's a U1 factor, and there is a Fayet-D term, which allows you to break supersymmetry. And so this actually fits beautifully, and was done in the RNS formulation by us and by Berkowitz and Witten in the pure spinner formulation. So even though there can be a singularity, you can actually handle it. You can control it. What happens at genus 3?
There's also a supersymmetric vacuum nearby.
Yeah, because it's perturbed.
Some of the scalar fields that have tree level D terms that cancel the one loop D term. So physically, you don't expect the vacuum that you computed, that vacuum energy in the SUSY breaking, is to be the where the right theory sits.
Yeah.
It wants to go cancel the SUSY breaking by shifting those other depths.
So now let me illustrate a little bit what's going on at genus 3. By the way, the case of genus 2, this I think in some senses must be relevant to the ambi-twister string. The genus 3 case I think may not be, but I just thought about this for the last couple of days. So what happens at, in the genus 2 case, you're basically looking at this separating generation, which I think will matter in the ambi-twister string. So let me discuss the genus 3 case, and then it will become clear why I'm saying that this will probably not be relevant. Nonetheless, I'll give it to you, since it's an obstruction for string theory to go to genus 3 in an easy way. So some basic structure theorems. So a hyperelliptic surface is a branch double cover of the sphere. I think you all know that. So all genus 1 and all genus 2 surfaces are, in fact, hyperelliptic. But hyperelliptic surfaces do not span all genus 3 surfaces, and in fact, they form a variety of complex codimension 1 called the hyperelliptic divisor. So let's take our favorite period matrix again, for even spin structure, and extend it to genus 3, which is possible. You need to add some higher terms with more gravitinos, but it's completely known, and it's of the same type. What happens for genus 3? Well, actually, what happens, remember the Zagor kernel had this theta function in the denominator. What happens is that this now can vanish for some spin structure on the hyperelliptic divisor of M3. And this object sits in the middle of moduli space. It's not at the boundary of moduli space. Okay. So basically, what's a hyperelliptic surface? Well, it's a double cover of the sphere, so it always has a Z2 involution. So what happens is that you basically approach this hyperelliptic divisor, and suddenly you have two copies of it, but moduli space tells you to only keep one. So you need to divide by the Z2, and this creates a singularity. It's very similar to, in genus 1, you know that the fundamental domain actually has orbifold points. But somehow there, it doesn't really matter, because there are no odd moduli. Okay. So it's just part of an integration of a nice function over this domain. It doesn't really matter. But when you have odd moduli, they can create a singularity of a delta function type with this kind of singularity. So that's actually what happens. And now, actually, this, of course, again, signals that there are direct zero modes. And these direct zero modes, when you don't have supersymmetry breaking, again, come to help you and actually kill these singularities. So you would think you're in business. But Witten actually found that there are other spin structures for which this doesn't vanish, which do have a singularity on the hyperelliptic locus. This is very subtle, I must say. It's in an appendix of a long paper, and the appendix is long. It's subtle, and but it does occur. And it had a practical effect, which was that after, you know, we put forward the genus 2 answer, people, for the measure, you know, people say, oh, well, maybe we can guess genus 3. Actually, we were part of that. But we found it was very difficult, and somehow it didn't quite work. But there were many papers published with various proposals of it. And in fact, you know, this simple fact here, this singularity, rules out all of these proposals. So at this point, there is no real proposal for genus 3 measure. Let's see. How long should I speak?
People have been asking questions. And, okay. In the low energy limit, of course, is Marcus' work.
I was going to come to that, right? Uh-huh. So how long should I speak? Because I.
We always say an hour, but we really mean an hour and a half, including this.
Okay. Well, you know, you can just tell me to shut up at some point if you can't take it anymore. As I said, this part, starting here, is recreational string theory. This is easy. Okay. Compared. Yes.
Just before you move on to a question, we've discussed the separating generation. Mm-hmm. Is there anything coming from the non-separating generation where you have to pay?
At genus 2, not that I know. You have the expected singularities. And actually, Witten, in, I think, the paper on low genus, has a very extended discussion of what happens in the non-separating degeneration and finds that the measure works and everything.
So if you were to take this non-supersymmetric, non-tachyonic string, do you have a feeling for whether things would go through to the same order as in the superstring, or whether you would get into issues earlier, since you mentioned...
Right.
Supersymmetry.
It sort of all depends on how many direct zero modes you have at any given singularity. So I don't quite remember for SO16 square what the story is. We can look it up. I don't remember. It's a long time ago.
Yep.
Yes. Okay. So here, now I'm sort of changing gears, and basically, very even the genus 1 amplitude. Sorry, Lance, you cannot evaluate, you cannot do these integrals, you know, for the full amplitude. But if you look at the low energy effective action or effective interaction, then actually you can do integrals and you can make predictions. And in the case of type 2b, there is an interesting structure of S-duality, which combined with supersymmetry gives you constraints on what the effective interaction should be. There should be modular forms, but now not on the world sheet. There should be modular forms in the dilaton axion field. Okay, so this is an enterprise where you can actually calculate things and compare with various predictions. And in fact, you can, you know, have even, you know, produce information on what the behavior of the effective interactions in type 2b should be. Okay, so, you know, Michael Green gave a talk about some of this here, so I'm going to just highlight the things that he did not talk much about. So I think you all know, if I now show the four graviton amplitude type to be a genus 0, this is a beautiful formula. And it has a 1 over STU, which is actually the exchange of a massless particle at tree level, massless graviton, essentially at tree level, and produces singularity. But then all the rest is actually an analytic expansion in ST and U. And this KK tilde factor at the level of an effective interaction is the linearized form of a remount to the fourth effective interaction. This is contracted in a way consistent with supersymmetry. And then having additional S square and so factors gives more derivatives, also arranged in a way consistent with supersymmetry. Okay. So from this formula, from expanding the gamma function, I don't need to teach you that. You know that you get zeta values. You get all kinds of interesting zeta values. So now what I'm going to be interested in is looking at the four graviton amplitudes in type 2b, actually, at higher genus, and get a handle on the contributions of these effective interactions. Well, let's start with genus 1. So this is the amplitude. I just wrote down exactly the same amplitude. And so I'm going to look not at the full amplitude here, but I'm going to look first at the partial amplitude. And the partial amplitude, I'm interested in expanding in small Mandelstam variables. Well, actually, the first pole is at S equal to 1. So that means that this expansion is actually convergent with finite radius, S less than 1. So you can see that because G at coincident points behaves like a log, and I can always integrate that log to any order I want. So a contribution of order G factors of the Green's function by just power counting in S will contribute to an effective interaction of the type D to the 2W, R to the 4. So there's a, we call this number W the weight. It will occur all the time. So the Green's function on the tor is extremely simple. It's just 1 over p square Fourier transformed, where p is the lattice momentum of the torus. Okay. So when you integrate over the moduli, then of course you will produce branch cuts starting at 0. So if you wanted to define the effective interactions for that, you would have to do something like what you did at tree level. You have to extract the non-analytic part at S equal to 0 first, and then define the effective interactions. And there is a long history of doing how that works. So, okay. So basically, then, we need to do ordinary field theory of a massless scalar field in two dimensions, but on a torus. That's a little bit unusual in high-energy physics, but if you were doing, let's say, graphene physics in the form of a torus, then that may well be something you want to look at. So the counting I gave you tells you that at d4, r to the 4th, I'd have to evaluate this graph. There are no derivatives on these vertices, and the full graph is a vacuum graph. There's no momentum going in or out, zero momentum. Then at d to the 6th, r to the 4th, is this, d, and so on and so forth. So you get more and more graphs, of course. So how do you study these graphs? Well, it takes not too long, not too long to see that, in fact, I organize these graphs by the number of loops on the world sheet, viewed as a field theory now on the world sheet. So these graphs are one loop. Here we have graphs that are two loops, and graphs that are three loops, and so on and so forth. And in fact, it's advantageous, not surprisingly, to analyze these graphs not horizontally, but actually vertically, loops by loops. So that's what we'll do. And so, you know, we've been doing this for a little while. So the result is a function that depends on the modulus of the torus. It's a modular invariant function. And so it's a way, actually, of associating to a graph, any graph, a modular function. So this is why we dub these objects modeler graph functions. Okay, let's see what happens to genus 1. Well, here we have just a one-loop worldsheet Feynman diagram on a torus, so it's just a sum over an inverse power of the momentum to some power, whatever that power is, whatever the number of insertions you have here. So here would be 2, 3, 4, and so on and so forth. Well, that's a known object. It's actually the non-holomorphic Eisenstein series. It's not holomorphic because P is dependent holomorphically on tau, but then I take the absolute value. So it's a non-holomorphic generalization of modular function, modular forms, as you all know. What are their properties? Well, this is a very nice function. It's absolutely convergent, can be analytically continuous, satisfies a reflection relation. It's modular invariant, and more importantly, it satisfies a Laplace eigenvalue equation. Satisfies a differential equation on the genus 1 moduli space. Well, what happens to genus 2, to two loops? Well, you need to evaluate these Feynman diagrams. They again give modular functions. We now have three momenta, but there is a conservation relation, so it's two independent momenta. And then you have inverse powers of the momentum square. So just an ordinary Feynman graph, but you can associate with it a modular function. So now, in fact, we found that these things also satisfy differential equations of the Laplace type that I wrote down here. And I think Mike Green exhibited some of that, some of those in his talk. But they're no longer homogeneous. The right-hand side, which is a polynomial in the ordinary non-holomorphic Eisenstein series. Note that the, you know, pseudo-eigenvalues which come in here are like angular momentum. So actually, we proved the structure theorem. What are these, in general, what do these modular graph functions satisfy? Well, they satisfy a differential equation, Laplacian minus some pseudo-eigenvalue on the right-hand side, which is a polynomial in the non-holomorphic Eisenstein series. And there is a beautiful structure here, which I wrote down. Reminds you a bit of spectroscopy, I guess, in atomic physics. But the eigenvalues are all, you know, regularly with essentially periodicity 6 in the weight. And you can prove this. I'm going to go a little bit fast here. You can prove this by introducing a generating function for all of these graphs. And that generating function is nothing but the sunset diagram, but with loop momenta which are running over the lattice of a torus. And so actually we showed that this whole thing satisfies a Laplace equation with an operator, which is the quadratic Casimir of SO2(1) acting on a hyperbolic plane. So it, there is a lot of structure there, and I'm not going to show you how to prove it, but having a differential equation typically allows you to integrate. Okay, so more interesting, let me do genus 2. So here again is the case for type 2, could be type 2b. I think all the symbols here have been defined. Now you immediately notice that the presence of these y factors for type 2b, you have two of them, immediately shows you that this amplitude, if I neglected everything in the exponential argument, would actually vanish at s is equal to t is equal to u. And that means that the leading kinematic, the leading interaction, which is really r to the fourth, actually has no contributions to genus 2. Okay. While at genus 1, there was no such suppression factor, and there was a contribution. And this is consistent with the predictions from s duality and supersymmetry. D to the fourth, R to the fourth, well, you need two factors, and you have two factors. So actually, if I set the entire exponential to 1, this is the term you get. And in fact, it can be calculated, and Fong and Goodperl and I did that. And you find exactly the answer that is implied by supersymmetry and S-duality. And then to order d to the sixth r to the fourth, you need to bring down one power of the Green's function. Now this is, so the expansion looks something like this of the partial amplitude. So this is the contribution, d to the fourth r to the fourth. And then there is one of d to the sixth r to the fourth. And so Michael and I tried to evaluate this and did not succeed at first, but showed that it's related to an invariant in number theory that was introduced just a few years before by Zhang and Kawazumi in this form. And they had their own reasons for introducing it, nothing to do with string theory. So, okay, so that's good. Then we wanted, of course, to integrate this over gene of two moduli space in order to make a contact with the predictions from S-duality and supersymmetry. So we needed to evaluate this kind of integral of an object that we barely knew. And basically, we talked to our math friends, Zaguier in particular, who said, you are crazy. You can never do this integral.
But you knew what the answer was.
Yeah, but it's just a number. It doesn't depend on anything, you know? I mean, that's sort of hard to say.
Then you just do it numerically.
Well, yes, we actually thought about that. But this is an integral. You see, here you have two-dimensional integrals, two copies of the surface. That's four. In fact, I think I have three. And I even got an account on the Hoffman cluster and never used it. And then here you have an integral over the moduli space of genus 2, which is six-dimensional. So it's a total of 10 dimensions.
People do those integrals all the time.
Well, I don't know. I would be happy if I could do a two-dimensional integral numerically. So you're really talking to the wrong person. Except, well, so as I said, the direct evaluation appeared completely out of reach, at least to us, until we actually showed with Boris Piolin and Rodolfo Russo that this object also satisfies the differential equation. Now, I didn't write it down, but the Laplacian here is the Laplacian on the genus 2 Ziegle upper half space. You just write down the Laplace-Beltrami operator with the metric that I wrote down a couple of slides ago. What does this mean? So there is a funny eigenvalue here, certainly not corresponding to angular momentum, but then this is gene of 2. And there is a right-hand side, and the right-hand side is a delta function supported on the separating node. Not something you would guess, probably. So now how does that help you do the integral? Well, you want to do this integral, which you can't do, but I can get 5 from here, and the rest is a delta and a something that's supported here. So this integral you can do, because the integral of the Laplacian, you just unfold it to the boundary, pick up the contribution. And this thing, we also knew the exact normalization, because you know the asymptotics you can compute with standard technology. And that number is exactly the right number.
So are both terms pi cubed times the rational number? Or does something cancel when you add?
Oh, I have to go look. They're actually essentially a factor of two of one another, I think.
Okay.
So I think they're of the same kind. Yes. Okay, so here, in fact, I wrote down a table, but I think my Green in his talk pretty much wrote down this table already of all that's pretty much known. So from space-time supersymmetry and S-duality, starting with Green and SETI, they wrote down differential equations, solutions of which are non-holomorphic Eisenstein series. If you go here, it actually also has a right-hand side, and so on and so forth. And here, I listed the predicted relations. So the predictions from S-duality and supersymmetry give predictions, which in these cases have been matched and match exactly.
So these Eisenstein series are in the complex parameter, which is the dilaton slash axion field, as opposed to the world sheet.
Yes, that's right.
Now you're
going
to expand them out and get these.
Right. I can, if people are interested, I can tell you more in the question session.
Do you have a more general message? I mean, you're doing your wizardry with not seeing differential equations.
Yeah.
Some idea where, like a more general message about how to construct differential equations in the low energy limit. To
yes. Michael Green and I are working on that on Genus 2. And we believe that there will be such equations. But it's tricky. It's complicated.
And of course, the next question is, do you think that that might be helpful?
Well, I'm basically hoping for perhaps somewhat, in an unjustified way, that we will in fact end up with a structure theorem like this for genus 2. I haven't shown you, but for genus 1, this kind of equation also allows you to integrate. Okay, because again, you reduce every integral that you have to basically exposing all these Laplace operators. So that would be actually the goal. Okay. Now,
I understand it right, it's a little different from differential equations or integrals that depend on a parameter.
Yeah,
instead, he's writing the integrand as a total derivative plus something localized.
Yes. Uh-huh. In this case, at least. I mean, I think in higher cases there will be more stuff on the right hand side. But yeah,
the differential equation itself. That still seems pretty useful, yeah. Independent of helping you do the integrals.
Yes. No, I think that's right. I mean, the fact that these differential equations exist, I think at genus 1 we understand. At genus 2.
Not yet.
I mean, we have one example that works beautifully, but beyond that, it's unclear. I mean, deep down, I think we sort of know where this comes from, because what is a Laplace operator on moduli space? It's basically a holomorphic variation times an anti-holomorphic variation. That means that effectively in field theory, you insert a stress tensor and its complex conjugate. Okay. We know that that's an anomaly type calculation. And hence, it must localize in some way. That's the best I can say. Okay. And in fact, this equation was established using complex structure deformation techniques. Okay, so I have 6 minutes left, and so this is the...
Actually, so you still need to answer the question about five loops, the Wiggins problem in five loops.
No, I think I did answer it. Yes. I didn't write it down as such, but I did answer it because, it's earlier.
But then you said it was believed to happen even in three
yes.
loops. So then
yeah,
five doesn't right. seem to be special anymore.
Yeah, that's the right.
Yeah, I don't think that there are also, I'm even here simplifying things a little bit because, as you know, certainly with Neuver-Schwarz states, you could treat surfaces with punctures or not. You can integrate the vertices or treat them as punctures. And the counting of when these holomorphic projections exist with punctures or without, not the same, actually. So it's even a little bit more subtle than this. But for genus 3, I showed you the singularity, right? As explicitly as I could.
Maybe just one quick question. There's a reason why Henrik was asking.
Yes, of course, yes.
Is there anything special about 5 that causes an extra difficulty?
No, I mean, they basically, Donaghy and Witten basically worked with embedded, sub-supermanifolds and somehow they needed a larger dimension. It's unclear to me that 5 is fundamentally special. Okay, so this ends the part of the talk where, I know this to be true, but perhaps relevant. So let me just have one view graph of speculation, and I call it speculation because it is probably not true. But basically, I know that there is a fundamental formulation of the Amy-Twister string, which people have worked on and so on and so forth, and which works and so on and so forth. But I just wanted to play around with, is it in any way possible to get the ambitwister string from, you know, chiral amplitudes? Okay, so I don't mean this to be true, but I mean it to be sort of a seed for discussion, you know, an opening for discussion perhaps on this afternoon or on Monday or on Friday. So, first of all, is there some natural structure that you could think of which would come close to the ambitwister formulation? Well, we have seen that, right, the massless singularities come in a sense from the cusp in genus 1, but then also in genus 2, it comes from, you know, the compactification divisors. So modulized space is not as such compact, but it can be compactified by the Delinier-Mumford divisors. Divisor simply means that it's complex codimension 1, and it's obtained by adjoining, by completing, at the boundary, by completing modulized space by the contributions from these separated surfaces and from the surfaces with non-separating degeneration. So there's a lot known about these divisors in the bosonic case, and I'm not sure it's written down. A lot of these things were done by Delinier, who is famous for writing letters, but not necessarily writing papers with the same content. And I have not seen all the letters. So these divisors, at least for the bosonic case, are reducible to this decomposition that I gave there, and have normal crossings, which means that they actually intersect in a non-degenerate way, which is, I think, important. And so if we call the non-separating divisor delta 0, this actually defines a cohomology class. I know this for the bosonic case. It was proven by Haarer and Wolpert in the middle 80s, and it's presumably true, I think, for the super case as well. So it seems natural, instead of integrating, there's a natural object, instead of integrating over all supermodulized space, to integrate over this divisor only, this divisor class. I think it's also important to rescale the loop momenta, because if you just set omega to infinity, that's not going to be good, so you have to rescale them in this way, but I think that's all right. And once you've rescaled them, then, in fact, you can go to this divisor, I think. And also, the rescaling will be done on this part in the chiral amplitude. Will actually immediately, it will automatically introduce an ultraviolet cutoff, which I don't really know how it is done in the ambitwister string. It has an exponential cutoff because I define my variables, remember, by absorbing alpha prime in them. So it's in there. And the last part is this. Let me actually look at the chiral amplitude, and let me compute its deformation in complex structure and superconformal structure. So this is done by the symbols, which means that I basically insert a stress tensor at a point W, or I insert a supercurrent on the world sheet at a point W. And if this is my chiral amplitude, I've only written, you know, I haven't even written the fermionic parts, there are many more contributions, then that variation gives me an object pi square times f, where pi is this object here. So, of course, a lot of dots. And I think this is very similar, actually, although perhaps not exactly the right thing, but it's very similar to the ambitwister string, where you have an object called p, since I already called the loop momentum p, I called it pi, whose square is equal to 0 at all points. If it's 0 at all points, then I can identify the poles in it and set their residues to 0. And, you know, at least I think this is from my point of view, this is a possible way to approaching these questions. So it seems like I have an infinite number of equations here at every point, but of course I don't, because this object is automatically locally holomorphic, or actually meromorphic.
But since you that this is pi as epsilon.
Epsilon? What's epsilon? Yes, that's right. Yes. I know that. I knew this was going to cause some consternation. But of course, you have to realize that epsilon really needs to be brought down, right? The final amplitude needs to be multilinear in each epsilon. So even though I put it in the exponential to evaluate, it really needs to be brought down. So my hope would be that it gives something close, I mean, related to these Pfaffians that you have. But again, it is, as I said, pure speculation. Now, why would I like to do something like this? I mean, this, after all, is setting to zero the dependence on moduli or supermoduli. Why do I want to do something like this? Well, of course, I don't really know. But I could imagine that this is a way, actually, of constructing a form, a differential form, on supermoduli space that's closed. And then it would make sense to integrate that closed form against this cohomology cycle. Okay, well, I think I overran my time, so I'm going to stop here.
Any last comments?
Yes.
About the previous story of Lorentz. You go to higher G at 4 points. They're not interested going at higher points, say, one loop.
Yeah, well, higher points at one loop has, there are quite a few papers, which I did not attempt to do a complete bibliography. But there is a calculation which I actually didn't lift because it doesn't quite fit in this pattern, but there is a calculation by Gomez, Mafra, and Schlatterer on the five-point function computed to two loops, but in the leading low-energy approximation. And so there is at least one calculation. It was done in the pure spinner formulation. That's the only one that I know of at two loops with more points. But at genus one, they're all,
the lots of calculations. There are many other higher loop computations in superstring theory which have been done in the past, like Anton Jarvis, Gartner, and Ryan Taylor, they computed endpoint G loop topological partition
formulation. Oh, topological, yes. Yes, that's right. There's a story that I haven't discussed here, which is the topological strength, in which case, yes, there are calculations to any order, I think.
Yeah.
Right. So here I really stuck to the physical, you know, type 2 and hadronic strength. Yes.
Concerning your speculation, do you have any idea of how that could come out as an alpha prime going to zero limit or something like that?
Yes. Well, I mean, you know, to the level that it's speculation. yes. I mean, I think this rescaling here, in my view, is fundamental because it will give you an exponential. So including the factor of alpha prime, it actually gives you alpha prime times L squared. So it has automatically an exponentially cut off regulator in it. And then here, well, you know, we would have to work this out, exactly which terms remain. There may be other scalings that you do. Perhaps left and right are not scaled in the same way. That I don't know.
But is there anything that restricts your integration to your non-separating divisor instead of the moduli
yes.
space with the alpha prime?
Well, that's the idea. Oh, with the alpha prime? I'm not sure how to deduce that from first principles. I mean, the only thing I was saying, there is a natural divisor, there is a natural cycle, okay, which is a cohomology cycle. I know this for the bosonic string, I don't really know this, but I think it's true. So there's a natural integration region which is not moduli space, but which is, you know, one of these divisors. So that, I think, is well defined. So the question is, can we construct essentially a closed form here on this thing? And that would give you a natural thing to do. Whether this is the right thing, you know, but it would be natural. The alpha prime probably kills some terms in here. I'm sure it does. But exactly how that, I think you know better than I do. I mean, it would restrict some of these prime forms to the skinny handle limit and so on and so forth. But I think in some sense, I think you touched on, Ricardo touched on the key thing, is the appearance of epsilon. How does that all fit together? Can one make that fit together? I'm not saying this is, you know, the right thing, But certainly we start with something that has the right spectrum of states. And so, you know, it would seem to me to be a nice starting point. But I've learned about ambitwister strength from Julio, mostly at UCLA from his talks, and from Ricardo and Yvonne, but that knowledge is extremely limited. So.
Thanks a lot, Eric. That was a very beautiful talk.